a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. Continue the quiet mood and make space for the silences and the shadows of our lives. You may use these first few minutes to light candles of memory and hope, or just to sit quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. In an attitude of prayer, sometimes we can't find our way or can't recognize the way when we have found it. Sometimes it seems the cost is too high to take the high road, and so we settle for a lower one because we feel it's all we can really afford. Let us take these moments to remind ourselves of our higher calling. Let us be open to hearing the voices of gods rather than idols, consulting those angels of our better nature rather than the little demons and goblins of our lesser selves. Let us think and act in ways that can do honor to us and to those we love. Let us act as though God were watching, as though those whom we love were watching, as though all the great and noble souls of history were watching us. For we are the gatekeepers of our better tomorrows. We are all of us, brothers and sisters, children of God, and the best hope of a more compassionate world. Let us live in such a way that when we are finished, we can say, in my time here, I was as compassionate, as courageous as I knew how to be. In my time, I was, if even only in my small way, a blessing to those whose lives I touched. I came, I cared, and in the most important matters, I tried to be authentic. I wasn't perfect, but I was the best person that I knew how to be, and that is enough. It is enough. It is always enough. Amen. The sermon title came from a radio program probably most of you here have never heard. One that began, "Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows." See, some of you know it. Someone gave me tapes of 6 programs from that, and they found out I was preaching on it. One of the most famous and beloved story plots we have in any culture, I think, in any culture, is about people going out on long adventures to find treasure that winds up being buried at home. After the first service, someone came up to me to tell me that this is also the foundation story for Temple University, something I hadn't known, that they have a story called The Field of Diamonds that they used on the road to get money to start Temple University. It was the same plot. Someone going out looking for treasure, but it's really here in this field of diamonds where we're going to build Temple University. God, it's a famous plot. We love it. You think of the movie The Wizard of Oz. That's the story. Dorothy goes to Oz to look for things she can only find in Kansas, but doesn't know it. And the home she's looking for is always as close as clicking her heels, but she didn't know that either. And the 3 other main characters in the movies, they were all characters in Kansas. And they came looking for things that they also had at home and didn't know. A brain, courage, a heart. They didn't know it. I think it's one of the biggest doors into religious stories, mythic stories, fairy tales, movies, all the stories that we've loved, is through this plot of looking for something in the wrong place when it was only at home, if only we knew how to look for it. Now, I try to use a lot of different roads to talk about religion because we have a lot of different styles of belief here. And the style of belief doesn't so much matter. I don't care whether you use God talk or nature talk or talk in terms of great myths or biographies or histories. It doesn't much matter to me what you call it as long as you can call it forth. And what we're trying to call forth is that sense of a bigger life with bigger possibilities that both welcomes us and challenges us. So this morning I want to use a side road to get into these questions, and the side road is to come through Jungian therapy. I think the work of Carl Jung has been a very strong friend of religion and spirituality for a long time. Jung pursued spiritual goals through psychological means, or almost ordinary language means. For him, what salvation was about, and it's really the root of the word salvation, was wholeness, health, wholeness. Salvation comes from the same Latin root as the word salve. It's about healing and wholeness. And for Jung, that wholeness could only come if we can combine the parts of ourselves and our minds and our souls into what Joseph Campbell once called the coordinated soul. What a wonderful phrase. That meant for Jung that we take our favorite parts of ourselves, those parts we love to brag about and show off, and we have to combine them with the parts we've hidden or that have been hidden for us or from us by others. That's the shadow. Now, this shadow business sounds spooky to talk about it, like I'm going to be drifting off into a galaxy far away, but it's not true. It's very down to earth. And I'll have some down-to-earth stories later. But I want to explain what this shadow is and where it comes from. When we're in a relationship with another person, everyone here knows this, there are parts of us that that other person likes better than other parts. See the laughter? See? And the other person encourages and rewards those parts, but not the other parts. And the more the relationship matters to us and the more we find ourselves growing into it, we find ourselves stressing the parts that the person we care for likes and rewards and not stressing the other parts. We shine a spotlight on the parts that are loved and rewarded. The other parts go into the shadow. It's really that simple. The same is true in our families and extended families. Every one of you knows your family had certain parts of you they really liked, and they would praise you when you showed those parts, and then there were those other parts that they didn't praise. And when you wanted something, then you acted out of the parts that you knew were going to be praised and rewarded, and the other parts went into the shadow. The same is true in a society. Every society has certain traits that they reward, and there are others that are never mentioned, and those go into the shadow. So the shadow, and it's different for each person, and it's also different for each society. The shadow is those parts of us that haven't been integrated into us, the parts that have been shunted off somewhere. What do you do with them? In our culture, our cowboy culture, especially recently, when we find two opposing forces, and light and shadow sound a lot like opposing forces, we are taught to use the bigger one to destroy the weaker one. That's the plot of virtually every action movie, almost all war films, much political talk. Use the powerful one to destroy the weaker one, and that's how you resolve it, with a victory. Whether that really works in international relations remains to be seen, but it does not work psychologically. They're all parts, and they're going to have to be integrated sooner or later, or we'll pay the price. What's the price? The price is that the parts we can't integrate will gain power the longer they're kept in the dark, and they will often rise and run our lives like mad puppeteers. Now you can see how people project their shadows out that they can't integrate. We project them in our society into our horror movies, our action movies, gangster epics, violence, the violence that's everywhere, shocking fashions, so on and so forth. But that isn't integrating them. That's just putting a dramatic face or giving a dramatic scream to parts of us that haven't been integrated. When they erupt, they can erupt as psychosomatic symptoms, a black mood, unconsciously inspired accidents, or in war, economic chaos, strikes, racial intolerance, all the rest of it. We know all the characters well. The front pages of our newspapers hurl our collective shadows at us every day. It's a dark side of human history when people make others bear their shadow for them, because then those people become scapegoats. And their job is to carry the shadow away so we can stay in denial about it. Historically, in our country, men have done this to women. Whites have done this to blacks. Blacks have done this to Hispanics, as I learned when I moved to Austin. Catholics to Protestants, Protestants to Catholics, capitalists on third world countries, Hindus on Muslims, Muslims on Hindus, on and on and on and on. Seems to be one of the great plots we have, that those who are different from us and who are often showing some of our shadow sides get turned into scapegoats that we drive away so that we don't ever have to grow up. But you can't live in Oz. You can only live back home, and you can only do that by growing whole. Now, all that was a kind of theoretical introduction, because most of you people are way overeducated. And many of you believe, as I do, in salvation by bibliography, where the saints are all footnotes. In real life, this stuff is all much more simple and dramatic and very easy to see once you look for it. So I brought you some stories about this, some real life examples of lives being run by shadows, or lives not acknowledging shadows. The first one, I'm trying to do this from personal, then religious, and then national. The first one comes from a woman I knew some years ago, a woman named Betsy. And Betsy was in a shadow rut. Her whole social life, her whole love life was being run only by her shadow. And it's never going to work that way. Betsy dated a series of men who were all judgmental and dismissive of her. And they all seemed to be the same guy wearing different masks. And after some of us had seen about three or four of these guys go through, we asked Betsy if any of these characteristics, judging her, dismissing her, not really liking her much, if any of these things seemed familiar, if she'd ever seen these before. This seemed like a small revelation to her. Well, she said, only in my father. And she told the story about a father who had been judgmental, dismissive, and abusive for years. And Betsy had been seeking her father's approval her whole life. She never found it, and she was never going to find it. Never. So now she's playing this out in relationship after relationship, where what she's looking for in dating, the only men she finds attractive are men like her father, who, if only she could get their approval, might fill the gap left by the hole created by the lack of approval from her father. Sound complicated? We live it out every day. She's never gonna get it. Because the kind of people who might give it to her will never find her attractive, and she won't find them attractive. And until she can affirm herself, she'll never be able to look for the kind of people who want to be with a healthy and integrated woman. That's how complex all this stuff is. Religion. It's almost easier to talk about the shadow sides of religions than it is to talk about the other sides of religions. I think in Christianity now, when the worst flavors of it are gaining so much power in the country, and people like Jerry Falwell, who I think are immensely charismatic, influential, and I think they're hucksters, are teaching that Christians should be gearing up for a war against Muslims, and teaching that Islam is a religion of war and murder, apparently forgetting all about the Crusades. When Christian soldiers were taught to go kill Muslims and were told they would be rewarded with eternal life in heaven for doing so. Now that's shadow play. When a Christian now talks about Muslims as teaching war and murder, and Christianity is the religion of sweetness and light. No religion is only of sweetness and light. No people are either. The only hope that kind of virulent Christianity hopes of being whole is to incorporate its own shadow side, own its own contributions to evil and murder and injustice, and then a really great religion can become really great again instead of really dangerous. Another thing on religion that I'm not going to go into a lot of time on because I think I'm going to have to do two or three sermons on it sometime this year, are all the shadow elements in Christianity that have been brought to the surface by this book, The Da Vinci Code. It's a wonderful read. It's just a wonderful read. I've now read five other more scholarly books on it, and I have about 8 or 10 more to read, because what The Da Vinci Code does is bring every theory floating around up into this book. Not all of them can be true, but some of them are. Some of them are clearly true. And if even one of them is, then the people guarding the books, the teachings, and the secrets of Christianity have been deceiving believers for 2,000 years. And that's true. What's most likely true? I think that there is becoming to be overwhelming evidence that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married, that the wedding at Cana was their wedding. The word Magdala means the greater. If Mary Magdalene is Mary the greater, who is she greater than if not Mary the mother? I think there's beginning to be overwhelming evidence of this, and that they had children, probably three, a girl and two boys. That the years of their birth are known, that alone, that's quite a revolutionary thing, if that's true. Many Christian thinkers have known it was true for centuries, but have believed that the believers needed to be spared this. Some of the theories brought out in the book, The Da Vinci Code, I think are probably not true, because everything is there. But they're fascinating. So I'll take a series of sermons sometime this year to explore some of this stuff and try to sort through it. Now, for a really broad example of a current script written by the shadow, I think of the United States' historically amazing claim that we have the right to wage preemptive war without provocation against anyone. The Treaty of Westphalia of 1648 was the treaty that helped establish international peace and international diplomacy. And one of the key parts of the Treaty of Westphalia is that no nation ever has the right to violate the boundaries or the integrities of another sovereign nation. So this claim is almost unprecedented, and when you look for precedents in the 20th century, they're not polite. These were the precedents of Nazi Germany and of Japan in the early 1940s. That claimed the right to violate the integrity and the boundaries of other nations. This is an amazing claim that we're making. For it to work, we would actually have to be able to conquer the world, which is part of what the New World Order is about, and what some of the neoconservatives are beginning to be very, very clear about. I've seen and heard William Kristol on radio and television interviews. Some of you have too. And he has now been extremely candid, shockingly candid to me, that yes, some of the members of his group, including Cheney, Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and others, have been urging an invasion of Iraq and a regime change since 1991. That this isn't new. Yes, he says, we will control Syria and Iran next. And yes, he thinks we can do it without using our armies. You have to see these statements against a world stage of people from other countries who are hearing them. And imagine, you think they might want to do something about it? Could this have anything to do with Korea's insistence on boosting its nuclear weapons capability for their own self-protection? Can the shadow side run the play without any repercussions ever? Doesn't seem likely. There are some encouraging signs that this shadow side will be discussed, and that has to be discussed and acknowledged before it could ever be integrated. I think the fact that that strange and wonderful movie, Bowling for Columbine, actually won an Oscar is an amazing sign that a huge number of people are recognizing the shadow side and willing to exalt it. And I think even the fact that Michael Moore's incendiary and angry and sometimes screwy book, Stupid White Men, made it to number one on the bestseller list 4 or 5 times over the period of a year and a half, means it's not being buried. Having lived through the Vietnam era, as some of you did and many of you didn't, I think that this degree of awareness of the shadow side in the Vietnam era did not occur until the publication of the Pentagon Papers in 1972. And it's already occurring this time around. So I'm encouraged to think that so much is known by so many and is being discussed so widely. Our media don't carry the story, but many who've read foreign media, have seen Canadian broadcasts, who get shortwave radio, all the different ways there are of getting foreign media, know that in other countries in the world, the United States is widely seen as the most dangerous nation on earth. That other countries have said and say that George W. Bush is more dangerous and murderous than Saddam Hussein. That's amazing stuff. That's part of the shadow of what's going on in our country now. I think we need to acknowledge it. Now, all this stuff about the shadow, besides being so depressing that we seriously consider just passing out razor blades with the orders of service, but it also holds up the usual association we have with the shadow, which is that it's bad, because usually it is. But it doesn't have to be bad. All it means is these are the parts of ourselves, whether individual selves or national selves, that we haven't integrated. And they can be good. I know people, you may know people, who are living out of parts of themselves they shouldn't be, and whose best parts are buried. Then the shadows are salvation, and that's what there are thousands of myths, fairy tales, and religious stories about. That's the story of treasure buried at home that we don't believe is there, so we look somewhere else for it. That's the looking for love in all the wrong places story. And I have a favorite story about this. I wanted to leave you with something so you don't go kill yourselves when you leave here. God. It's a true story about my oldest friend, John. I met John in 1968 when I was finishing my undergrad degree in music theory, and he was finishing his PhD in psychology at Michigan. John rode a big Kawasaki motorcycle, which he could take completely apart and put back together, and did a couple times a year just to make sure that he could still do it. He loved fixing things. He could fix anything. He was in psychology. He loved fixing people, too. And that's what he looked at people as, things to fix, machines with broken things that he needed to fix. And where I saw this at play most was in all the women he dated because they were all work projects for John. What was most attractive to a woman about him, once a few other things had been checked off, was that she needed work done, and he thought he could do it. This made for a very colorful line of girlfriends. They didn't last long, because most of them got real tired of being another one of John's work projects. Once, when he was between very colorful girlfriends, I said, John, what would happen? I mean, God forbid, because this would be a terrifying thought, but what would happen if you ever met a woman who was healthy, completely in love with you, wonderfully compatible, and didn't need work done? And he said, that wouldn't be attractive. Absolutely dead serious. Straight face. That wouldn't be attractive, he said. About 25 years ago, after visiting England for several summers, John moved there. He still lives there. He has dual citizenship now. He said that the U.S. felt to him like an adolescent society, and he wanted to live among grown-ups. A few years later, he wrote to say that he'd met a woman named Mary. So I thought, well, grown up or not, England has some work projects for John. So he'll be happy. He told me that Mary was going through a divorce and through the legal and the emotional hassles of dividing a very successful travel agency that she and her husband had owned. I didn't think John knew anything about that, but I was sure he could find something to work on there, so he'd be happy. A year or so later, they visited while I was living in Chicago, and I got to meet Mary. Mary was John's worst nightmare. She was a completely healthy, happy woman who loved him, was compatible with him, and didn't need any work done. When we were at dinner and I realized this, I said, John, I don't understand what you ever found attractive in her. And he said, it wasn't my fault. He said, I was blindsided. He said, at first, he said, she needed work done. He said, she was all upset, and he said, I was attracted to that. And then, when the divorce was over and the business dealings were settled, he said he suddenly discovered that she wasn't broken and she didn't need fixing. But he said it was too late. He said, we'd already fallen in love. And he said, I'd been seduced into a healthy relationship in spite of myself. John and Mary have been married about 21, 22 years now. John's shadow, the part of himself that he couldn't integrate for reasons to do with his biography and his childhood and all the things that we bring into life and carry along with us, the part he couldn't integrate was the simple trust that people are basically healthy people and loving, and that love is a gift that you can simply accept. It isn't a do-it-yourself kit that you abandon once you've put it together. It was the part that trusted life and trusted others. And one of the great ironies in John was that he had moved to England because he wanted to live among adults rather than adolescents. And then, in spite of his best intentions, he actually met an adult and outgrew his own adolescence. It's a funny story. In some ways, I could always identify easily with John and Mary, and I love their story. But in other ways, those two are very different from me. John's always been. They are both into every screwy supernaturalism that has ever come down the pike. Astrology, numerology, palm reading, phrenology. I still remember the day when John felt the lumps in my head and told me my future. Don't do this. This makes me crazy. When I went to graduate school and he sent me 3 hours of tape he'd made doing my astrological progressions so I'd know what the next 3 years would bring. And I actually listened to all 3 hours. Not one bit of it ever came true. None of it. Just makes me nuts. For a while, when I was so alarmed by this, I thought about trying to make John and Mary a work project. And then I realized that these were two people who'd found their own path toward wholeness, toward happiness, toward health. They weren't broken. They didn't need fixing. And I decided to just bless them and leave them alone. So we've remained good friends. They from their galaxy, and I from mine. And to each of us, the other is from a galaxy far away. So much life comes from the shadows. You'd think that we'd get over our fear of it, but we don't. We're afraid of the dark. We're still afraid of the dark. And I think we're afraid of the dark because we really fear that the truth will be bad. I've heard that called the most faithless that anyone can be, is to fear that the truth will be bad. But every one of us has had that fear. It's as human as it gets. Betsy was afraid she couldn't live without her father's approval, which she would never get. She only could become free when she realized she didn't need her father's approval and could look for people who, like her, were no longer broken. Some Christians are afraid that if they build bridges toward Islam and other religions instead of walls between them, if they acknowledge some of the parts about the man Jesus that have been hidden for so long, like perhaps the fact that he was married, that people will no longer fear their God and obey their religion. I think what people lose in fear, they would more than make up in trust. Our current administration seems to think we can only be safe by being able to threaten everyone else on earth. That seems unlikely. It's easy to wonder how the answers could come from what seem our weak areas, our shadow areas, our vulnerabilities. How can there possibly be vulnerabilities more powerful than strength? But thousands of years of mythology and religious teachings say that's the way it usually happens. In the Hebrew scriptures, Isaiah says that the stone the builders rejected will become the cornerstone. In the Christian scriptures, someone says, what good could come from Nazareth, which was a backwater place of low repute? But it's where they said Jesus came from. In virtually every story we know, the hero comes from the shadows, from the fringes. From Jesus to Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz to Frodo in The Lord of the Rings or Harry Potter, it's the weakest character who turns out to be the strongest, the one who is able to build bridges between parts of a disjointed world and to find what Joseph Campbell called the lost Atlantis of the coordinated soul. Within and among us, it's often our hidden parts that hold the power and the knowledge we need. And so we perch between two kinds of life, two kinds of belief. The belief that the truth will be bad, and the belief that the truth might set us free. We perch between fear and life, even as we know that there are mostly two kinds of people in the world, those who are alive and those who are afraid. And the message I've tried to share this morning is a simple one, taken from ancient insights and modern psychology and fairy tales and children's stories and movies. It's simply this: don't be afraid of the dark. Those things you need to know to be more alive are as close as clicking your heels. You can trust the shadow. The shadow knows.